Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Art and Artifice, what Jane Austen has to say to a modern readership.
Now, we're being a little bit cheeky this week.
You can't even use the Bronte excuse by saying that Jane Austen included ghosts or witchcraft or fortune tellers in any of her books, because she really didn't.
No. She kind of touches on the gothic genre at one point, but there's certainly nothing really that speculative about it. That being said, we've been going for a while now, and I feel like...
We'll break the damn rules if we feel like it.
Yeah, we're allowed to just every now and again indulge. And as both Jules and I are quite big Austen fans, we did think that it was time that we kind of brought her out more than just passingly and actually dedicated an episode to her. You should be glad, though, because I'm pretty sure Jules and I could talk about each individual book for an episode. So yeah. We're going to try and keep it all together.
Yeah, so consider this sort of an introduction to Jane Austen scholarship, if you will. And there's enough demand. Hey, we're happy to do that. We will do a series of episodes just on Jane Austen. And separately. There's a lot you can take away from Jane Austen, both as a writer and a reader. And I think, I don't want to say that the books go over people's heads, but they don't. You have to bear in mind that there's at least 200 years standing between the modern reader and the text. Yeah. And even in their time, they didn't quite hit at the time they were intended to because of various publishing issues she'd had. Therefore, some of them came out sort of 10 years after they were the most relevant. Which is interesting in terms of the scholarship side of it, which I'll go into. But it does mean that when we talk about how she did her writing and why lots of things get missed, it sort of explains, I think, why people think these books are one thing, then really they're something completely different.
Yeah, I quite agree.
What I'm getting at is the fact that I think you say Jane Austen and people think, oh, light Regency romance, money, morals, manners, and that sort of thing. And actually, they're intensely political novels about various things that she saw as unjust at the time.
Yeah.
She took issue with them. So that's where we're going with this today.
Yeah, as you say, that there's a lot of political veins that run through Jane Austen, and even if you aren't necessarily aware of those, even as a modern reader, there is a lot of feminism actually in Jane Austen, and a lot of people, you can turn your nose up at that and say, oh, but you know, it's all about women finding husbands in the end. To which I point out, it's all about women who fall in love with people who see them as equals, and also, there's a lot of wish fulfillment there because they all end up in very happy kind of circumstances as well. It's the ultimate. someone did a great analysis of it where they basically went, it's like the opposite of the Bechdel test.
Just not sure if that's right.
Well, they're in so much that you don't. It centres around women. And there was this one person, and I don't even know it because I just happened to see it on Twitter, who basically complained about the fact that you never saw any male conversations which weren't in the presence of a woman, in that it concentrated on the line, and whilst the men were there, they were seen from the point of women. And given the writing of the day and the subject and all of the intense focus, I don't know, I think that's pretty cool, actually. And I think a lot of people kind of misunderstand it and what its purpose was.
Okay, well, I will come into this because I want to try and do this in order so I'm not just spewing lots of information.
Yeah, sorry.
but ultimately, that's one of the things that makes these books deeply political, but we will go into that. Before we actually get to the point of talking the books, I think it's worth just talking a little bit about Jane Austen, because people have made assumptions about her, just in the same way they've made assumptions about Emily Dickinson and Virginia Woolf and various other female writers. And most of those assumptions are bullshit. So I'm going to say that right now, they're bullshit. Yeah. from the position of somebody who's done an awful lot of reading around the subject and actually bothered to read her letters and read other works and look at the people that she's actually influenced and everything. I'm not saying I'm an expert. I'm absolutely not. But I will say that if you can read all of that and still come out with conclusions like Jane Austen was an impoverished spinster, and she was a spinster because she had no choice, and all she really wanted to do was get married, but she was forced to write novels and things, then you've really missed the point, and it genuinely has gone over your head. So let's explode some Jane Austen myths. let's tackle the big one first. The fact that she wasn't particularly well off and she was a spinster, and therefore she's sort of a pitiable figure.
Now,
yeah, she wasn't very well off. She was one of eight children. Father was a country vicar. Her mother was an educated woman who came from some means, but obviously if you have large families like that and your income doesn't keep up with your expenditure in terms of how many children you have, then things start to get a bit tight after a while.
Yeah.
Quite understandably. There was the parsonage at Steventon. I won't go do an entire biography, but the way they did families back in Georgian England was very different. And I think the trouble is people mistake the Georgian sensibilities for the Victorian ones. The Georgians were very open about things like sex, marriage, and procreation. The Victorians were very private about it.
Yes.
So that's one big hurdle that you kind of need to get over, first of all. The second was how they thought about their children. They loved their children, but it was perfectly normal if you had a large family, then for one of your children to be fostered away with some relatives who might not have any children of their own and ultimately be adopted by them and inherit their wealth, which is what happened with one of Jane Austen's brothers. Yes, so the idea that she'd had no opportunities for anything else and was kind of forced into writing, this is propaganda that was put about by her nephew and her great-nephew, who never met her, and by her brother, her brothers, after her death. Now, some of that was politics, because we've said that she wrote deeply political novels. She did. And this was back at a time where there was no freedom of speech, and if you wrote or said things that disagreed with the Crown or with Parliament, then you could be imprisoned for it.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what social strata you came from, or if you were male or female, they would lock you away. No doubt there were contemporaries of Jane Austen who thought her father should have had her locked away in an asylum for having political opinions, which was the general opinion with women having opinions about politics at the time. So
charming.
When I say, you know, she was taking a big risk by saying some of the things she did, and even as she said them covertly and encoded, which she did slightly, her writing was an act of rebellion. There was something seditious about it as well.
Mm.
So I cannot imagine anyone saying, oh, well, I'm going to write these really, really deeply intrinsically involved miniature brushstroke type novels, because that's a lot of work, particularly when you don't have a laptop or a word processor with a quill and ink, just because you've got no other choice to make your money. Of course you have. Jane Austen had three proposals at least in her life that we know of, and she chose not to. So she stood by her opinions with marriage, and then that's encapsulated very well in her books, in the sense of there is no point getting married to somebody who cannot value and respect you for yourself, or who you cannot value and respect. So let's get away from the idea that she was this poor spinster who couldn't do any better for herself, because that's simply not true. She had a lot of female friends. She had a very close relationship with her sister Cassandra, and yes, they weren't especially well off, and sometimes lived an uncomfortable life whereby they sort of had a nomadic existence, staying with one relative and then another before going back to their own very small cottage. And they had to become mistresses of economy, which they managed. But to say that she didn't have a very, very rich inner life and a very rich vein of friendships, then to assert that none of that could compensate for the joys of being married or having children, it is just utter bollocks. And I think that's a mindset we ought to have moved away from by now.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that a lot of people say, oh, well, okay, but it was fine back then, and sort of don't really engage with the fact that people, even though circumstances and technology and moralities might have changed, people themselves haven't actually changed. And I think that it's not exactly a stretch of the imagination to envision Jane Austen having the same kind of thoughts and wants and, you know, genders as any kind of modern woman at all. And the idea, the problem is that everything we get from the Regency period in particular, you know, has that sort of that sense of romance and describes this sense of purpose in a woman being married. And that is how she finds joy and fulfillment, to the extent that we somehow rather ridiculously think that that was therefore how all women of the period felt, and that to not adhere to that would be a tragedy of some kind, when in reality that we have no evidence that that's actually how women felt at all. And in fact, we have a lot of evidence to show that there were women who didn't feel that way and were happy and content not to be married or involved in that particular kind of vein of society.
Yeah, absolutely. And while there was a prevailing and rather sexist mindset that a relatively poor gentlewoman who has never married is a figure of pity, and I wonder how that came about, because that certainly wasn't generally other women or those independent women putting it about.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was a mindset. But there was, if you ever read Jane Austen's letters, and many have survived, even though Cassandra's probably, well, there's no doubt she destroyed the ones, she burned the ones that were most inflammatory. And Jane Austen did not pull her punches in her letters to her intimate acquaintances. Some of the things she said were very funny, but very, very sharp. You think I'm scathing, that's nothing to Jane Austen. Genuinely nothing. It's kind of like, I could take lessons from this woman. I really could. So, yeah, there's that prevailing sexist mindset. And even though they didn't have the word sexism or feminism, Jane Austen clearly thought, this is a sexist mindset. I value myself as I am. I value myself as I am far too much to marry somebody I don't love. And certainly far too much to risk my life marrying someone I don't love, which we will come to when we talk about Northanger Abbey.
Yeah.
So, other myths to explode. These are two that are probably going to get me lynched by a certain... Actually, it's worth saying at this point, I'm a member of various fan clubs. On one hand, I'm a member of the Stephen King Constant Reader fan club, and they're some of the nicest people you would ever meet. When you think of how horrific his novels are, this is the nicest bunch of people. On the other hand, I'm also a member of the Jane Austen Society fan club. Oh my god, if you want to see people really go for each other, like proper cockfight on the internet type stuff, really, handbags at dawn, just suggest something that is not received Jane Austen canon and then sort of step back. Because, oh my god, I've never seen anything like it. It's terrifying. So yes, these people are going to probably lynch me now for saying these things, but this is after close reading of the texts, as it were. And one is that Jane Austen didn't talk about sex and just wouldn't conscience the fact that it was there or that it should be talked about. It was kind of a no-touch subject, which is just utter rubbish, because if you actually properly read her books and then later, if you actually read her letters, she's quite explicit. She talks about masturbation, she talks about abortion, she talks about contraception, such as it existed at the time, and she's quite bold. She gives advice to her niece, for example, and things like that. Not to mention, she used to make some incredibly crude jokes. There's one in particular that sticks in my mind. She's writing it to one of her friends. It might have even been Miss Sharp, who was the governess of some of her young siblings, and they were talking about her being at Southampton and had she seen any likely prospects, and Jane Austen making some very, very sharp comments about the rear admirals, with emphasis on the rear, as it were. So there's letters where Jane Austen saying, yes, I've been checking out their asses, and a few of them are quite, you know, are quite pleasant sights kind of thing. So they're very funny, but they're also quite rude, and people forget that the Georgians were actually quite bawdy. This was a no-touch topic.
Absolutely. The thing that always gets me is that actually, if you look at the books, they are full of sex.
Yes.
They're full of sex. It doesn't happen on the page.
Yeah, it doesn't matter that there's never even any kissing or anything. It's explicitly there in a lot of the scenes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I didn't know that I did the letters, though. That's really interesting.
You have to kind of read through. I mean, there's hundreds of them. So I think some people find it a bit daunting. And she was an absolute mistress of really sort of writing one way across the paper and then writing across the paper in a diagonal direction. So not to be funny, Madeline, but I think it would make your dyslexia sort of jump all over the shop, because it even makes me go, oh, looking at the actual letters.
Just hearing about it is making my head spin.
But they have been properly put into a book by Deirdre LeFay, and it is worth going through and reading them. They're very interesting. They're very funny. And I know people sort of a bit dismissive saying, well, she's talking about the minutiae of life. And it's like, well, actually, that's the sort of stuff that should have interested her. And it gives us a real insight into the time period as well. But I've digressed slightly. Okay. Jane Austen myth number 3. This is the one that's going to really get me in trouble. She may not have been completely straight.
No, that doesn't surprise me in the least.
There's no evidence, and there's no surviving letters. Again, maybe there were at one point and Cassandra destroyed them on Jane Austen's death. But she certainly formed a very, very intense friendship, of which her close acquaintances and her family did not entirely approve, with Anne Sharp. Anne Sharp was the governess of some of her younger siblings.
Yeah.
And she was a playwright. I don't think she ever managed to get any of her plays produced at the time, but she was Jane Austen's writer friend. And I know you'll understand when I say that, yes, you might have lots of friends, but if you're a writer, there is something very special about a writer friend, on somebody who can meet you at that level and understands what you're talking about and all the pains and pleasures of actually writing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it was incredibly warmly affectionate. There's probably nothing going on, but it's warmly affectionate in a way that kind of makes you think that perhaps it occurred to one or both of them at some point. So to make the assumption that, you know, she was this poor, impoverished little old spinster who was secretly heartbroken she'd never got the chance to marry, and, you know, wasn't appreciated for her novels much in her own lifetime, which is true, had terrible trouble with their publishers, again, is also true, and didn't make an awful lot of money herself. Again, that bit's also true, but to say that this makes her a pitiable person and that she didn't live an incredibly rich and fulfilling life is missing the point, I think. So anyway, that's my ranty bit about Jane Austen myths that really bug me. There are others, I'm sure, but... But I mean, it's, you know, one of her proposals came when she was in her late 30s, and she sort of said, I don't think so, I don't think we'd make each other happy. Except, you know, she probably said it a lot more cleverly than that. A lot more sharply if she didn't like them.
Yeah. She's actually buried in Winchester Cathedral.
Yeah, although it took years before there was any definite engraving.
Yeah, because she came to Winchester at the end of her life when she was ill. Apparently lots of people came to Winchester when they were ill. It was where you came. Keats came when he was ill, obviously. So this is where Winchester is where writers go to die. And I'm here already.
Okay, thank you for that reassurance. I'm going to suggest we move on to the books, and we're going to be flitting back with the books to talk about aspects of Jane Austen's life, because it is actually really important in how she's getting things across in the books. I will mention her juvenilia first. I'm not going to go into too much detail, because I actually haven't read all her juvenilia. But the one I do want to mention is something she wrote at the age of 15, which I think really proves that anyone who says that she's not an extremely feminist writer, very much taken up with the injustices of the world, is absolutely talking out of their arse. And also that she had a great sense of humour. So she was 15 and she wrote a book, it's just a little pamphlet really, called A History of England by a Partial, Prejudiced and Ignorant Historian. Now, Jane Austen was rather irritated that the history books of the time never really mentioned women. It was like the men kind of got there by themselves, you know, they procreated by themselves. Women weren't involved in anything at all. They just sort of turned up in the 1700s, which irritated her no end.
They hadn't been invented yet.
No, exactly. So it's so sad, isn't it, the fact that we talk about homosexual and queer people sort of just turning up in literature at a certain point, and black people turning up in literature. It's like at some point it was actually women. So this history book, written when she was 15, is a bit childish, but it's also very, very funny. And she has written it with the sort of view of, I don't care, I think this makes a better story. And she's kind of put the women back in and given them really funny roles and things like that. It was clearly written for the amusement of herself and her sister, and possibly her father.
She had a good relationship with her father, didn't she?
She had a really good relationship with her father. Her father encouraged her in terms of her literary ambitions, and, you know, he encouraged his clever daughter. I mean, he clearly loved all his children. His wife loved all his children, but she had quite a difficult relationship with her mother. And I think that was just one of those ones where her mother was very intelligent as well. Her mother wrote poetry, and the two of them were... Possibly it was a case of, until Jane became of a certain age, the two of them were just kind of butting their heads together. And you can understand how that can happen in a family. But yeah, her father really supported her and obviously acted as her agent. Unfortunately, rather badly at times. Not really understanding publishing at all. So if you're a writer and you're feeling bad because you got dicked over by a publisher, it happens to the best of us. Literally happens to the best of us. Just a little aside. Let's move on to Northanger Abbey, which is one of her early books, which I don't think met its audience. Northanger Abbey was bought initially by the publisher, and then it sat in the publisher's drawer for something like 12 years.
And Jane, that's nice.
Jane kept sort of politely writing to them saying, if you don't want to publish my book, perhaps I could have it back. And they're saying, well, you must give us £12, whatever they paid for it. It was, you know, it was a significant sum. She couldn't have come up with it just out of that.
Yeah. So
they, as far as they were concerned, they'd purchased all the rights. And the whole copyright issue was, that was pie in the sky back in the late 1700s. Northanger Abbey, on the surface, looks like a poke at the Gothic genre. Jane Austen was a huge fan of Anne Radcliffe, who wrote some of the Gothic novels of the time, and I want to say Christine Burney, but it might not be Christine. But there was Evelina by Burney as well, which was one of the big novels of the time. And innocent young heroine goes to a Gothic-esque castle, discovers lots of mysteries, and, you know, somehow manages to keep her wits about her and her innocence, etc. Which is kind of essentially what she's doing in Northanger Abbey with Catherine Morland. Except that there isn't really a big mystery on the surface.
No. But there's a lot of things that are actually happening underneath. It's one of these books which is... I'm surprised it was her first, I believe you, that it was. I know it wasn't published until significantly later.
It wasn't published until after she died,
until after she died. But it's... Because it's actually an incredibly subtle story. There are a lot of subtle elements throughout.
Yes.
But for those who don't know Northanger Abbey, just a very quick one. So it's basically about young girl, Catherine, who, like Jane Austen, comes from a very, very large family. I think Catherine's father is also a vicar or something of the like.
Yeah, that's right.
She and Catherine is of novels, but in particular the Gothic novels, and she spends a lot of her time reading. And she basically, as with most of these stories, it involves her leaving home and then sort of ending up in dire straits, embarrassing herself a little bit, and then falling in love.
Yes, she basically, Catherine starts off the book very early on thinking of herself as a heroine. And you should be able to hear the inverted commas there.
Yeah. So
the heroines are things like The Mysteries of Udolpho or Evelina. Frances Burney, that's the author I was trying to say. Frances Burney, God, my head. When she gets the chance to accompany, I think it's an uncle and aunt, but it may just be sort of family friends, to visit Bath. You know, she's far too poor to have a London season or anything like that. But, you know, there's a chance of extending her acquaintanceship by going to Bath, and she's sort of 15, so she's a very young girl. She's Lydia's age, but she has a lot more common sense.
I thought she was a bit older. I thought she was about 17.
No, I think she starts off 50. She's sort of 15-16. She's the younger end of the heroine scale.
Okay, all right.
And it's a really she meets Henry Tilney ultimately. And, you know, to start with, he's a decent enough chap, but he's not necessarily very interested in her until she sort of takes him by storm by being so utterly artless and honest with him, and then suddenly he starts to become quite interested, and obviously she forms a friendship with his sister as well, and yeah. She also forms a friendship with another girl who is far less well-intentioned and reputable, and Henry's older brother is far less well-intentioned and reputable, and it sort of goes on from there. Henry's sister invites her to stay at Northanger Abbey, and Catherine's sort of expecting several weeks of gothic delights in a haunted castle and is very disappointed at various... She keeps finding things like things written on papers which turn out to be laundry lists, and a secret passageway that nevertheless sort of just turns up somewhere else in the house, and everyone's like, yeah, we knew there was a passageway there. And it's all very disappointing for her. And she's so determined for there to be a mystery that she ends up sort of suggesting to Henry that she thinks their father may have killed their mother. And Henry's slightly offended by this. He's like, well, yes, my father is a bit of a bastard, my words. And he probably neglected my mother, but you're accusing him of being a murderer. You know, have you taken leave of your senses kind of thing? And they have a bit of a row.
Yeah.
And then Catherine finds herself pitched out of the house in the middle of the night and shoved in a carriage and sent home to Moreland. And it's she sort of thinks, oh god, that's it, I've lost my chance with Henry because I've just basically accused his dad of being a murderer.
And which is not a great thing to do.
It's not a great thing to do. But the thing is, Henry does, you know, when Henry calms down, he's also sort of horrified by the way his father's behaved. And the reason his father has chucked her out, it's got nothing to do with that. He thought that Catherine Morland was an heiress, and when it turned out she wasn't, he decided she was a little money-grabbing pretender and had her very rudely thrown out in the middle of the night. You simply don't do that with guests. You wouldn't do that with guests now, would you? But
no.
They'd have to do something pretty bad. So that, on the surface, there's that romance, if you like, of what friendships are good for you, and learning to rein in your impulses, indulging and enjoying fantasy, but at the same time not losing touch with reality.
Yeah.
It's about growing up and making good judgment. On the surface, underneath that, there's a far darker message to Northanger Abbey.
Yeah.
Which I can go into if you like.
No, please go ahead. You're explaining it much better than me. It's been a long time since I've acquainted myself with Northanger Abbey.
One of the things that Jane Austen makes reference to in many of her letters, you have to bear in mind that a lot of her friends were married and they had children, or a lot of her relatives, her aunts, her cousins, again, were married. These were women that she knew. She was intimately acquainted with, you know, the vagaries of childbirth and your likelihood of surviving it. And the problem, really, was the fact that people went into marriage and most people didn't practice any real contraception. Contrary to popular belief, contraception was widely practiced during the Middle Ages and the medieval era.
Yeah.
And then we lost a lot of the information due to the witch trials, because suddenly the church was burning women who knew how to stop other women getting pregnant. So we lost an awful lot of that information.
Yeah.
So then you get to the sort of 1700s and you got married and you might very well be risking your life for someone. And Jane Austen was maintaining that it's not worth it to risk your life for someone you're not deeply in love with. It really, really isn't. And you'll notice that in a lot of her books, there are big families. Catherine Morland herself comes from 10 children.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a serial pregnancy. And in one of her letters, she said, well, I feel sorry for so-and-so because she's just had another little one. She's had far too many children so close together. It's wearing her out.
Yeah.
And this is a theme that crops up again and again and again. So you then have things like Catherine Morland's actually not entirely wrong when she suggests that Henry Tilney's father has actually killed his mother, because ultimately he has. She died in childbirth, it's said in the book.
Yeah.
And in the way, what's really interesting is the fact that generally in Jane Austen, bedrooms are not described. Bedrooms are considered private places. So the fact that she has actually described a bedroom and then gone into detail about the red and the white, and it's all very, very evocative of a woman sort of bleeding out from a bad pregnancy.
Yeah.
You'd have to go back and read it. So there's that aspect to it. And then what's I found fascinating when I did finally notice it. When you go back to the text of Northanger Abbey, Jane Austen repeatedly mentions abortifacients, and the message underneath is the fact that you do not need to have so many children so close together. You do not need to risk your life to, you know, to keep having children year after year after year. It will kill you.
Yeah.
And she felt very, very strongly about this. And it is worth, I think, also pointing out that this isn't a huge leap on my part, or on many other Jane Austen scholars' part, to say this. Because this was the era when, believe it or not, Boots the chemist wasn't always a chemist. It was actually once a rotating library. But you could actually buy pills and things from there, and nostrums, that sort of thing, and creams for your skin. And one of the things they used to sell was women's tablets. Women's tablets, you know, part of women's business. And they would reliably restart your courses once anything had upset them and make them stop.
Right.
You could send off for them. There were adverts in the paper. And from the male perspective, these weren't considered to be abortifacient. And they didn't always work, in fairness, but sometimes they did. If you got them early enough, certainly. You could send off for them, take them, and your periods would restart again, and anything that you might have accidentally conceived was gone. So this is a big advocation in terms of bodily autonomy for women, and the fact that Jane Austen's making it very explicit in the novel that there's all these things you can try before you have to have child after child after child is a big advocate for that. It wasn't illegal either. Up until about 5 months, when the child was quickening, or, you know, started to move around and kick, it was considered a woman's business whether or not she brought that child to term or not. The law changed in the 1800s, the late 1800s, sorry, 1830-ish. And then it became illegal to actually destroy a child in utero.
It's interesting as well because one distinct sort of theme that I got when I was first introduced to it is that, and I might be entirely wrong, maybe I was, you know, projecting, or I might have been completely misunderstanding it, was depression as well. Because the father, he's quite vampiric.
Yes.
And I believe there is an adaptation where she literally accuses him of being a vampire. And he's quite vampiric, and he sort of sucks the life out of everything. He's very unpleasant. He's quite miserly. He wants more and more and more, and he doesn't leave a lot of room for or openness or creativity or any of these things. He's an incredibly controlling figure. And I always got this sense that, yeah, he basically drew the life out of this woman who died, despite the fact that our impression of her was that she was the lightness to this guy's darkness. She was a loving mother. She was a nice person. Now, of course, this is because she's remembered. So you always think of people more fondly in a golden light, usually, if you've lost them at a young age. But she's this very kind of lovely figure. But you're right, the kind of the rooms and the way that things are described, and I just seem to remember everything kind of being shuttered and dark and gloomy. Sense that, yeah, she just kind of, all of the joy was sort of sucked out of her, and that she became very, very depressed. And that there was this kind of this element of depression, and that maybe even the father himself was depressed or was completely disconnected from it or didn't want to engage with the subject. I don't know. Was I reading too much into that, do you think?
I think it's difficult to say, because after a certain point, the text becomes yours as much as it becomes anything mine or, you know, Jane Austen's, doesn't it? But I can see the point. It's not too far a step to then link it to, say, postnatal depression, which, you know, isn't something that we came up with in the 20th century. So this is a woman who had three children very close together, and the fourth one killed her. And the fact that the scene is of the bed, nobody goes into that room anymore. That was the marital bed, and that's the bed she died in. So to me, that's a very clear message of, however it comes about, you are risking your life by going into marriage. So bear that in mind.
I
love the way that Jane Austen layers things, and I'll go into the chain of association thing a bit more later, but everything on the surface, it's a light romance. It's one of the sillier Jane Austen stories.
Yeah.
And it is having a poke at the Gothic novel and saying, yes, these are lots of fun. I like to read them myself. But at the same time, you cannot let yourself get too lost in them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then you have layers and layers of, but you know what's really a Gothic drama and it's going on in almost every married household and nobody wants to talk about it? There's this. Perhaps we take some control over our own uteruses.
Yeah.
So that's always very interesting to me. Let's move on to more or less everybody's favourite, but actually not mine, Pride and Prejudice.
Yes. Was it Sense and Sensibility? Oh, I guess we don't need to do them in order. Of when they were, yeah, sorry. Okay, so Pride and Prejudice. So you say it's not your favourite.
Oh, it's a favourite book, but it's not my favourite of the ones Jane Austen's written. I will tell you when we get to that one.
It's probably one of my favourites, and probably because it was the first one that I ever encountered of Jane Austen's work, and so I'm incredibly memorable. Obviously, my first encounter with it was actually the BBC. Was it BBC? It was the adaptation with Colin Firth.
Yes, it was the Andrew Davis screenplay.
Yes.
Andrew Davis has adapted a lot of Jane Austen. He really, really understands his subject matter. And he gets a lot of these deeper themes in there, as well as the light romantic icing, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Colin Firth, Jennifer Ely one is the absolute gold standard for Pride and Prejudice, even though it does leave out a few things that are probably quite important.
It does, but I do feel like it really captures the essence of the story, and it's incredibly faithful, I think.
I think it is.
But, yeah, so wonderful, wonderful adaptation.
See, Pride and Prejudice is probably the closest thing Jane Austen ever got to writing a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And it is literally a Beauty and the Beast story, if you think about it. The fact that the beast, it's more his beastly behaviour than anything else.
Yeah.
Which is why certain other adaptations that just show him being a bit shy and stammery really irritate me, because clearly those people do not understand the story. I get quite annoyed, so I won't go into that. I think I've talked about...
the thing is... No, go on.
No, carry on, because my bit's really long, so carry on.
No, I was just going to say that I always see him as just being... having big social anxiety. Like, don't get me wrong, he was a complete dick about it, but I just think that he was just very uncomfortable in any form of, just very uncomfortable. For not the best reasons, I should add. You know, he did think he was above the people that were there. He was kind of sneering, and he's kind of is corrected with it.
The thing is, yes, he did, but it's noticeable that of the person who is always in power... throughout that book, it's Mr. Darcy.
Yeah.
There is never a moment when he is quite probably not the richest and most powerful and well-connected person in the room. So yes, he has horrible social anxiety, and he thinks he can get away with treating people badly. He thinks it's okay because there's a real superiority there. And he looks down on other people and sees them as small because of this, because they haven't come from his background or had his advantages. Rather than questioning whether or not they have their own feelings and agendas that might be just as important as his. And obviously that's something that Elizabeth picks him up on.
Yeah.
And the entire book ultimately is about equality. And it's very, very carefully done. In Regency society, when a couple was introduced together, to each other rather, it was assumed that the woman had the highest social status until it was discussed otherwise. You couldn't just walk up to somebody and say, hey, I have 50,000 a year, or I can expect a dowry of 20,000 pounds or what have you, which, by the way, would put you in the millionaire bracket today.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a significant amount of money. But it's really noticeable that all the way through Pride and Prejudice, there are a number of abortive attempts to get Elizabeth introduced to Mr. Darcy and vice versa. And either one or other of them completely scuppers these attempts. So they get all the way to the end of the book and they get married and they have never been officially introduced to each other.
Yeah. So they get married, but they've never actually been introduced. That's brilliant.
Yeah. If you think about the first occasion, and it's the famous one, you know, she's tolerable, I suppose, but not handsome enough to tempt me. See, Mr. Bingley is trying to get Mr. Darcy to stop standing around and maybe dance with one of the Bennet sisters and suggests Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And Mr. Darcy refuses to be introduced to her, which is the absolute height of rudeness in society at the time. What he's saying there is not so much, I don't want to go and talk to a stranger, or I'm feeling shy, or even I don't want to dance. What he's saying is, she is not worth acknowledging. Now, in a society where women were assumed to have social superiority until all the facts were laid out a bit later on, and yeah. the acquaintanceship had grown, that's incredibly rude. That's saying, you know, she's not much better than a kitchen wench kind of thing. That's how bad it was. It's not merely a sort of, you know, she's tolerable, which most people, if someone was standing off saying audibly they thought how sort of okay looking someone was, but they weren't really worth bothering with.
Yeah.
Most of us would not be able to turn that on its head and laugh at it as easily as Elizabeth does, I think yeah. it's fair to say.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that was incredibly rude. He's refusing to be introduced to her. Later on, at another gathering, Sir Lucas tries to introduce Elizabeth to Miss Darcy and present her as an honourable, as a highly desirable dance partner. Mr. Darcy by this time thinks perhaps he's been a bit hasty and perhaps Elizabeth is actually a lot better looking than he thought she was.
Mm-hmm.
And quite intelligent with it as well. And he tries to say, you know, I'd be quite willing to dance with you. But at that point, Elizabeth interrupts the introduction and says, no, I don't actually feel like dancing. I didn't move this way to be introduced to a partner. And actually stops the introduction cold. So this time, Elizabeth refuses to be introduced to him. They carry on like this back and forth through the book until Darcy kind of blows it out of the park by proposing to her, assuming that she'll say yes because he's got lots of money. And honestly, I think that's the most insane thing he could have done, because he actually does want her to love him, and he just assumes that his money will be enough of an inducement and perhaps she'll grow fond of him afterwards.
Yeah.
Not realising that at that point she literally hates him. She literally can't stand him. And he's been so arrogant he hasn't even thought about her feelings at all.
No. But then also, to be fair to him, I mean, don't get me wrong, he has been incredibly arrogant and very stupid. But to be fair to him as well, he doesn't know that she's been fed false information about him as well.
No, but his behaviour has hardly led her to question the information she has been fed.
No, absolutely. He's not been the best of the best, really, has he?
Right up to his proposal, which is so insolent that I wouldn't blame anyone for... Again, it's kind of in the vein of, well, you're tolerable, I suppose. it's that bad. It's like, I'm acting against my character, my reason,
yeah,
what have you. And it's so rude. Anyway, you get to the end of the book. Neither of them has actually managed to get introduced to the other one. Neither has ever been acknowledged as the social superior. So by the time they get married, they're embarking on a partnership of equals, which I think is lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. It is also something else that I think is very significant, is that he learns something from her, and he corrects himself for her. She calls him out on his bad behaviour. And instead of kind of her learning to tolerate him, he corrects himself. But he also stands up for himself when he says, no, these things are not true, are absolutely not true. And she's forced to reconsider the fact that she, at one point, because she disliked him, she was very, very happy to be misled. And she was very happy to nasty things about him and to assume that he was 100% irredeemable. And then the fact that she kind of actually has to realize that he's not. He's actually an incredibly kind brother. He's dealt with some tragedies in his life, and that, you know, there's more going on there. Again, doesn't excuse his behavior, and it certainly wouldn't be enough if it weren't for the fact that he makes an active effort himself. And when he approaches her again, he is incredibly respectful. He acknowledges what he did wrong, and he's actually grown as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously she has too. She's more receptive to him being a better person, and that she might have been wrong about other things as well. It's very telling, that line, until that moment I never knew myself.
Yeah.
It's a case of she'd never... she was taken by her own wit. And I can really understand that in some ways, because there have been times, I certainly in my younger days, where being a bit quicker than most of the people around me meant that I kind of assumed that my first impressions were correct rather than rigorously questioning them, which we all ought to do. And I think that's kind of what she takes away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also another bit, which is that when that there's a whole joke where she says that, you know, she only really starts to fall in love with him after she's seen how wealthy he is.
Yeah, once I saw his beautiful grounds at Pemberley. That's very honest and self-reflecting.
It is very honest and self-reflecting. And, I think that certainly she probably does look around and go, shit, this could have been all of mine. And I did just blow it off because I really didn't like him. And she kind of stands by it. She doesn't immediately go, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. She just thinks, okay. I think there's something very important there that a lot of people miss, which is that she gains a level of perspective.
Yeah, she does.
About him, which again wouldn't be enough if he then also didn't show that he was a decent human being.
Yeah, I mean, he does tell her some hard truths about her own family, and she is forced to recognise he has a point.
Yeah.
As well, obviously, which leads to the whole subplot with Lydia, etc. Yes, there's lots and lots of themes in Pride and Prejudice. I will mention one other thing. There is this misconception that in ye olden days that the sort of men who married young teenage girls were... it was perfectly acceptable. And in some instances that is correct. But it was actually very unusual for men to marry 15 or 14-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And they were not well looked on in society. Men who dallied with girls that young were considered the next thing to sexual predators, because the girls were not expected to be as wise as a girl in sort of at 19, 20, which was a more acceptable age.
Yeah.
And honestly, most women could not afford to get married until they were about 23. And that's among the serving class as well. They had to work in order to earn enough to get married on.
Yeah.
Yes, I know it's all very sort of titillating to go, oh, but in those days they all got married at 13, and actually it's just not true. It really isn't. So the whole thing with Mr. Wickham and the fact that he's got a thing with Lydia, you know, he clearly is a sexual predator. He is the absolute worst character, bar one, that Jane Austen produces, and she paints him in no flattering light at all.
Yeah.
And I think that's another one of those things where when people say there's no sex in Jane Austen, they're kind of really missing the point, because she's pointing out, you know, this guy here, you know, the really charming one who everyone likes, who's kind of got everyone on his side. Look what he's doing. He's going after 15-year-old girls, both for his own amusement and in order to try and get a hold of their fortunes. This guy's a predator.
Yeah, absolutely. And a predator who had struck, again, young girls before, and it was... This is, again, the other thing about him, is that he wasn't just a predator in terms of money, which is, you know, initially kind of what he did. He very specifically decided to target a young girl who wouldn't know better or who wouldn't be able to see him for what he was. But then also the interesting thing is that his charms worked with older women as well. He totally had Lizzie. At the beginning, she was not smitten with him, but she was charmed by him. She believed him. She really thought he was, you know, who he was pretending to be, certainly. And, you know, she is someone of good wit and good sense, you know, an incredibly intelligent character. So he could have had someone who was older, if he wanted to maintain this, you know, this lie. But he very specifically decided to go for someone who was silly, because he kind of wanted to silly. And when I say silly, Lydia is described as a very silly little girl, but she's just a young girl who suddenly likes the attention from a family of, you know, a lot of sisters who would have all been...
I suppose the other thing is her mother has encouraged her to flirt to attract male attention, and has put in her head from a very early age that that's where her value lies.
Yeah.
Now, Lizzie and Jane, and to an extent even Mary, have all been sort of, okay, we actually don't think our value just lies in that. We think there can be more to it, and we're going to act accordingly. But Lydia, who is her mother's favourite, it's a case of, no, it's what husband you can catch for yourself. Her mother's actually not very intelligent at all.
No, she isn't.
And again, I do not hold with adaptations that show her as a desperate woman trying to marry her daughters off. She's not. She's just... Mr. Bennet married very poorly, put it that way.
Yeah.
An amusing character, but... But yeah, so there's lots of other bits and pieces in Pride and Prejudice. Like, it's very noticeable that you've got Darcy, D'Arcy, and Catherine de Bourgh, and they're talking about the old French... You have to think about what was going on at the time.
Yeah.
Obviously, we were at war with France. France was having one of its revolutions, I believe.
One of many.
Madame Guillotine had much work at the time. And it's very noticeable that the people who object most stringently to Elizabeth having any sort of union with Miss Darcy have very French-sounding names.
Yes.
And it's a case of this is representative of the old imperialism, the old class, the old money, even though if you actually look at the coding, Lady Catherine de Bourgh is a baronet's daughter, which makes her barely above a commoner. It's the way the English aristocracy works, and it's very involved, so I won't go into it now. But it's really interesting. But basically, she's kind of almost nouveau riche, and yet she's adopting the attitude and manners of the old wealth.
Yeah.
And Jane Austen's point here is that this classism is redundant and it's actually very damaging to the country as a whole.
And weirdly,
rejecting it.
Weirdly enough, and you probably will correct me with this, but something I kind of discovered was that Darcy's name is Fitzwilliam.
Yes.
But the Fitzwilliam, like, I thought that the whole Fitz thing was afforded to bastards.
Yes.
Yeah, so he's been given a bastard child's name.
It's sort of someone at some point earlier in his family was a Fitzwilliam, so he was named for them. But that does, again, once again, underline the thing that they're gentry. They're very much gentry, and they haven't been gentry for as long as they would like people to believe. They've just been very successful getting there.
Yeah.
So, moving on from Pride and Prejudice, let's look at Sense and Sensibility.
Sense and Sensibility. So, actually, this is the first time we have a family who are not ginormous.
Yeah, it's relatively conservative with three daughters.
Yeah.
From one marriage, anyway.
From one marriage, yeah. But it does bring up this really, really interesting concept about the rights of women and inheritance rights, which is sort of touched on in Pride and Prejudice. But just the fact that you have this man who had a son by a previous marriage and then married again and has three daughters, basically has to beg his own son to take care of the daughters. And the son goes, "What does take care mean? A small stipend? Yeah, that'll do." And basically tosses them out.
Yes. They knew they were going to have to move out of the house anyway because that all went to him. The estate was entailed.
This isn't
something that can legally be done anymore, to the best of my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But usually that means that some way back in the midst of time, someone has set it up that the family wealth in the state must go to the oldest male relative. So if that's not a son, it would have gone to a cousin or to an uncle or to, you know, what have you.
Yeah.
Now, it is worth bearing in mind that the Women's Property Act didn't come into force until the 1860s, so about, I don't know, a good 50 or 60 years minimum later than Jane Austen has set Sense and Sensibility. And it's no surprise that the main theme of the book is money and how it corrupts people. And it's really noticeable in the way she describes things. They talk about gold and brass and silver. There's a very metallic feel to a lot of her descriptions in the book. We're never allowed to forget money and the fact that it has a huge impact on someone's life, and particularly on the three Dashwood girls.
Yes.
Yeah. It's an incredibly noticeable thing. I've seen essays which have suggested that neither of the two men who actually marry the two Dashwood girls are particularly admirable. And I can kind of see where they're coming from. I mean, I love the Emma Thompson Sense and Sensibility film. That's very special to me and my sisters. But I have to admit that when you actually read the book, it's very noticeable that Colonel Brandon, who is supposed to be the most decent guy in the book,
mm-hmm.
a very wealthy chap, almost everything he said is, I did this. I required this. I wanted this. This was done to me. Everything's an I statement. Everything is about him.
Yes.
And he's perhaps not as admirable as we all think. On the other hand, he's clearly a lot better than Wickham in many ways. Wickham, who just dropped Marion. Not Wickham. Willoughby.
Willoughby.
God, it's too
Willoughby.
Many W's. It's the W's. Mr. Willoughby. Mr. Willoughby, handsome, charming, with a wealthy aunt. He's clearly come from the product of the familial relationship I was talking about earlier, whereby a childless aunt or uncle has taken in a son from another family with far too many of them and made him the heir. But until she dies and leaves him her fortune, he's dependent on her goodwill. And the fact that he has been dallying around with various girls and got one of them pregnant, Colonel Brandon's ward, no less, and then left her in dire straits, and she had the baby and then died from pregnancy. Again, death through pregnancy, falling in love with a man who is not going to treat you very well.
Mm-hmm.
Can result in death, you know, literally, and not through some bizarre sort of the Revenge of the Sith type. My heart is breaking. I think I'm just going to die now. But a genuine sort of no, this birth was really bad. I had a child far too young at sort of 15, and my body wasn't ready for it. And now I'm dead. It's pretty graphic. So, the sad thing is that Willoughby genuinely did fall in love with Marianne. And he probably would have mended at least some of his behaviour for a while. You can't be too sure. And then he chooses to go after a wealthy heiress instead, because going after Marianne and marrying her when he'd done something that meant his aunt might well disinherit him, he couldn't live with being poor, ultimately. Not even for love, even though Marianne was actually willing to.
Yeah. So he chose money over love.
And Marianne even says, you know, I can see now, with the benefit of hindsight, that we probably wouldn't have been happy if those were his priorities.
Yeah.
She's a very dramatic and quite theatrical person, full stop anyway. She wants to run after life and throw herself at it. She's a lot more intelligent than Lydia in Pride and Prejudice. And she's not going to, you know, throw her virtue to the winds and just jump into bed with someone. And her very spiritedness is what captures the attention of both Colonel Brandon and Mr. Willoughby. And Mr. Willoughby's aunt in the book, Mr. Willoughby actually introduces her to his aunt, and his aunt approves of her. She doesn't mind that Marianne doesn't have much of a dowry at all.
Yeah.
She would have been okay with that. Her problem was the fact that Mr. Willoughby has a bastard. So, money makes fools of everybody in that book. Or, you know, money makes victims of quite a number of women and fools out of a number of men.
Yeah. And it also causes a lot of people to kind of stab each other in the back as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that there's a lot of betrayals that happen, a lot of women prioritizing, men above their friendships, their relationships with people around them, even their own health, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And obviously, on the surface, you've also got the theme of, again, only marrying for affection. Only risking your life in a marriage for someone that you have the deepest commitment and affection for. Someone who will make you happy, someone you can make happy. You don't know how long you've got life-wise, so really you need to make sure you're spending it with someone you can actually stand, which I wholeheartedly endorse that sentiment.
Yeah, I do think that is fairly important.
I think people see Sense and Sensibility and they remember Hugh Grant's charming, sort of slightly ineffectual, stammering Edward Ferris, and actually Edward Ferris deceives Marion, not Marion, deceives Eleanor from the beginning.
Yeah,
and
he does.
That's not admirable. He deceives her then, he deceives her later on, and then he deceives her when he comes to tell her that, you know, he's actually not married to the woman he was secretly engaged to for all that time. She's actually transferred her affections to his brother.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the Mr. Rochester thing, isn't it? Where when you have a character who unrepentantly deceives the heroine over and over again like that, you don't automatically think he's the good guy, or at least not until you see signs that he's redeemed himself. And you don't necessarily really see that with him. You don't see him grow a spine. So you know, as much as I love that particular film, and I really love the Andrew Davis adaptation of it as well, because I think it brings something more to the table, but it's just not, you have to think, yeah, they probably made the best matches possible, and I think they're both going to be happy, but at the same time, these men are inferior to them in terms of character, and I think we're supposed to believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. But you're making me rethink the whole thing.
That's what I mean. headaches for all of you. Let's look at Mansfield Park.
Yeah.
I've mentioned in previous episodes how Jane Austen uses the chain of association method in order to get a lot of her points across.
Yeah.
In Mansfield Park, she was doing something incredibly politically dangerous, and she was criticising the slave trade.
Yeah, which was, at the time, was a very, very, you know, hot topic, as it were, because suddenly people were going, is it right to own other people just because they have a different skin colour to us?
And it's worth saying, obviously, that we didn't have very many slaves over here, but a lot of the great houses, the great aristocratic houses that people like to go around and admire and look at now, even if they weren't built off the backs of, you know, sugar cane and plantation slavery and the wealth that brought in, they were certainly propped up and enhanced by it. Very definitely, the upper classes, the upper classes of the gentry and the aristocracy, benefited hugely from slave labour. And it was removed. That was the other problem. They might own huge plantations out in Jamaica and America and where have you. And they might own, theoretically hundreds and hundreds of slaves, but never actually really visit their plantations. The money just came in and they never really asked questions about where it was coming from. And that was the big thing Jane Austen was saying with Mansfield Park. She was talking about slavery and sexual exploitation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, I've heard people who say, does Mansfield Park actually endorse slavery? I genuinely have heard people say, it's like, oh yeah, it endorses slavery, it endorses the slave trade, which I think is a big misunderstanding for the book.
A radical interpretation of the text, put it that
way.
It's very, very critical. We teeter on the gap of 200 years whereby the author's meaning is, it seems very mildly put. It's actually not, it's an incredibly sharply worded book. Really, really being very, she could have got herself into some serious trouble with that one. The fact that she's disguised it partially with a romance on top of it.
Yeah.
Probably just about got her through the door. And, you know, the Prince Regent being an absolute moron also helped, I should imagine.
Yeah, I think that probably aided things. It's like
completely went over his head. Completely. Anyway.
It's interesting. There's an adaptation of Mansfield Park. And I don't want to talk too much about the adaptation. But for me, I really enjoyed the adaptation because it really did bring out some of those hidden themes forward and kind of actually reanalyze them more substance to some of the characters in doing so. And it's the Patricia Rosema. She was the one who directed it. It was a 1999 film.
I think I don't like that one because of various other things they've done. But you're right. Yeah. They did deal with the class divide between Fanny Price's family.
And yeah.
The Mansfield Park lot.
Yeah, but they also did something interesting, and I'm pretty sure it's this version. I might be wrong. It's been a long time since I watched it. Where they kind of added the older brother, Tom. So, the older brother, Tom, is in the book. He's kind of a bit, he does a lot of gambling, a lot of drinking. He's not very sensible. He seems to be, you know, kind of after the pleasures of life and gets into a lot of debt. He then becomes incredibly ill and almost dies. And what they did was that they actually used his illness and the way he behaved was actually in response to what he had seen on the plantations. And that his whole thing with his father was actually the fact that he was genuinely disgusted by what his father was doing, and that his father was a slave owner, and that he fully, that's where his whole, all of the tension between him and his father is, and that he's genuinely disgusted by it. And that's what's causing him to act out, because he can't actually do anything about it. So that was kind of interesting. I'm not sure whether it was a great message, but it was, for me, it really did bring and use some very harsh and very shocking imagery at the time, because Tom has actually drawn some of the things that he's seen out there. And to bring that kind of that theme forward for something which might otherwise have been, you know, sort of put to the background. And there is a very noticeable scene at the beginning when, they're right at the beginning where Fanny is, sort of in the carriage. And as she's being driven up, she looks out and there is a slaver's ship. They can hear sounds, from the slaver's ship, and they describe how they can smell it. And I liked that. I don't know about the rest of the adaptation. Actually, I saw it before I, you know, kind of before anything else. I was very, very young. But for me, it stuck with me.
See, it's interesting. And I like the fact that they brought that theme forward, because all too often that theme in Mansfield Park goes over people's heads.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it made the character of Tom utterly pointless, because that wasn't his purpose in the story. So that's kind of where I've got a little bit of an issue. And then you have things like, you've got Fanny kissing Henry Crawford, which is just utterly fucking ridiculous. it's the most ridiculous, not the most ridiculous thing ever, but it's definitely up in the top 10 for me. So, yeah, I wasn't a big fan of that adaptation. I prefer the one with Billy Piper, even though they've kind of missed the whole slavery angle entirely, because that clearly just went by them. I suppose the thing was, before I really kind of got to grips with the fact that Jane Austen's talking about slavery here, hello, I couldn't understand why I kept going back to Mansfield Park, because I don't like the main female character.
No.
This is where a really close reading of the text is important, because yes, she's an irritating little creep mouse and she doesn't seem to have much agency. She's not another Lizzie Bennet or a Charlotte Hayward or anyone like that. She's not automatically engaging. But what's very interesting is she's a survivor. She watches. She's careful. This is a person with no power, who has been brought up as a poor relation, literally, in a household with much richer cousins. Mm-hmm. Two male cousins who she has to be a bit careful around, one of whom is a bully.
Yeah.
An actual physical bully who knocks her about, or, you know, pushes her.
Mm-hmm.
In Georgian coding, a woman writing about a man pushing a woman is actually kind of like, this is someone who left bruises on her.
Yeah.
And two female cousins who look down on her, and just it's a continual downpour of emotional abuse. A negligent aunt and another aunt who is actually actively emotionally abusive and turns her into a sort of little servant. It's very Cinderella in that respect. And this ties in very nicely with the slavery theme. And you'll notice that Jane Austen, using the chain of association thing, she very cleverly links the plantations and the church. So slavery and the church. The church had a platform of supporting slavery.
Yeah.
And because it was believed that people of that particular ethnicity needed purpose in their lives. That was church doctrine back in the Georgian era England. And the church profited incredibly well off the backs of slaves in that respect as well. Same as the aristocracy did. And this is why so many of Jane Austen's vicar characters are creepy and exploitative and sexually a little bit weird and deviant in a really quite disturbing way. And it crops up again and again. And there's a suggestion that even Edmund, the cousin that she ends up marrying, is perhaps not questioning things as he ought to be. And perhaps he is not a very reliable young man either. He's just the best of a bad bunch.
Yeah.
So again, it's a case of this is not a reality of equals. This is Fanny Price picking the best scenario for her survival.
Yeah.
I would also like to point out that at several points during the text, her uncle, the owner of Mansfield Park, is kind of... she goes in fear of him. And I don't think she just goes in fear of him because he's got a loud voice and he sort of throws himself about a lot. She has to be very, very careful. And I think the reason she has to be very careful is she's seen him sexually exploiting other people, or seen evidence of it. It's very noticeable of Jane Austen's heroines that Fanny Price is the one who has her hair cropped really short, which wasn't particularly fashionable at the time. Nobody does it in an adaptation, but in the book she's had her hair cropped short. She dresses in a way to make her look more boyish and less appealing as a woman. And she stays quiet and she keeps her head down. She doesn't want to draw attention.
Yeah.
And this is right up until, you know, Henry Crawford and his sister turn up and it all turns into flirtation. And Henry Crawford is possibly the absolute worst Jane Austen character in the sense of he's a really bad guy. He's another sort of sexual predator. I can't remember. Was it Mary Crawford? His sister says the worst thing about Henry is that he needs to make every woman a little bit in love with him. You must allow him his diversions. And it's like, that's a terrible thing. This is somebody who actually needs to lead other people on.
Yeah.
In a society whereby male attention to female to females is supposed to signify their willingness to marry. And they've got money, they've got freedom. They've come from a background which is coded as kind of like quite abusive for children. You know, you're in a bad school for matrimony. So there's that. There's the sexual exploitation that's in the subtext of Mansfield Park all the way through. And again, that really links to slavery. And in that adaptation you were talking about, I think you don't see the uncle do anything. But
no, but you see images which suggest, that's
exactly what he's been doing. And
We're
supposed to believe that both he and Tom have been indulging in that in the book.
Yeah.
So, Mansfield Park is actually a lot darker than people give it credit for.
Yeah, it is actually.
Right, I'm going to move us on to Emma.
Emma.
Again, this has had many adaptations, including the 1990s Clueless. And if you want to read it at a surface level, it's about a rich girl with too much time on her hands playing matchmaker for her less intelligent friends.
Yeah.
But I couldn't understand. I wouldn't say Emma's one of my favourites, but it's got something. And I just kept coming back to it. And every time I read it, I felt really claustrophobic. And I couldn't entirely put my finger on why. Until I started reading about the Enclosure Acts. For anyone in America or the rest of the world listening, over here in the UK, we used to have a practice called commoning, whereby people could graze their animals on common land. It didn't belong to anyone in particular, but if you had a goat or a flock of geese or a donkey, or if you were wealthy enough to have a small pony or something, you could graze it on common land. And you could also grow things there and thereby supplement your income, which, wasn't large. But during the time Jane Austen was writing Emma, the Enclosure Acts were being drawn up. And what was happening was wealthy landowners were enclosing, that's enclose, I-N, rather than enclose. Enclose is something different. And they were making common land inaccessible to the people who had been grazing their animals on it. We had lots of various different groups of Romani people who would stop on the common land. And as I've talked about before, the Romani people followed the fruit and harvest picking trails around the UK. So they were actually a big part of the countryside life.
Yeah.
When the common lands were enclosed, there was nowhere for them to go. There was nowhere for them to safely set up shop for a little bit while they earned some money in the area and then moved on.
Yeah.
And this is where the whole idea of Romani people stealing comes from. Because the fact was they would graze their animals on the common land, they'd earn some money, they'd move on. Suddenly they couldn't do that and they were hungry.
Yeah.
So they did start to take hens from hen houses and things like that because they needed to feed their own children. There's no support network, no socialism or anything like that. And it's very noticeable in Emma that one of the first big violent acts was the fact that Harriet gets chased by a group of Romani. They tried to seize her purse from her, and she's very shaken up by the whole thing. But it's kind of something that has happened because the land is becoming enclosed, and it's really noticeable that the land specifically becoming enclosed, and it's actually changing the face of the countryside, is Mr. Knightley's land, the man she ends up marrying at the end. He's a man who has actually been gradually grabbing more and more wealth for himself, and yet at the same time is still claiming the moral high ground all the way through the book.
Yeah.
So really, really, Emma is very much about classism, and it's about admitting that the fact that the people who work the land are the legs you stand on, and that's a position that demands some respect. And that means you ought to be feeding them and allowing them to clothe themselves and paying them a wage on which they can actually live. And if you don't do that, what you're encouraging is a state where, at best, people are turning to thievery in order to feed their own children.
It's been a long time since I... well, my most recent interaction with Emma as a story was that actually fairly recently I watched one of the adaptations of it. So I'm very aware that with...
Is that the most recent one with Romola Garai?
With Johnny Lee Miller is the one, Mr. Knightley. Let's see. It was a series rather than a...
Yeah, I think it's Romola Garai playing Emma.
Yeah.
It was a BBC one.
Yeah. And so I think that's the most recent one that I've watched. I'm pretty sure it was a BBC one. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. And in that one, actually, Knightley is supportive of the travelers, and is very surprised when apparently, they attack somebody.
Yeah.
And even though I can just say, yeah, I can understand why they might have added that so that he's a more sympathetic character in the series, it did kind of raise something in my head, which was that the attack itself comes from an unreliable narrator. We don't actually see anything bad really happening. It comes... I mean, I can't actually remember how we find out about it in the book, but I'm almost certain... It comes that Emma isn't even present when it happens.
No, she runs to Harriet runs to her, I think, and tells Mr. Churchill, Frank Churchill,
yeah.
Sort of brings Harriet to the rescue.
In. Yeah. You know what happened? It might very well have been that the children were running to say hello, or to
Well, they were actually pulling at her dress, and I think they were probably begging for coins and things.
Yeah.
And it is a standard practice that if you want to beg, then you send children to beg because they're less intimidating than, say, a grown man would be.
Yeah. But certainly that this kind of this vicious and wild attack, which is, put forward there's real evidence of anything like that at all. And I liked the fact that in the series, this modern series, you have Mr. Knightley being like, I'm shocked that this would happen because it's his land and he's letting them onto his land. He's allowed them onto his land. He's happy to have them there. And he's very surprised when he hears that they've attacked someone because he says that doesn't sound like them. So that I think that was an interesting decision they made for the adaptation, but I think you're right. They probably just for us as a modern audience a little bit back in the day. Yeah, he's another one of these characters who, if you look at them with a microscope, under a microscope, doesn't actually bear up to full scrutiny. Not to a modern audience.
And it's quite telling with the name as well, the whole sort of knightly knight, as in the image of the old feudal system. And this was the last of the old feudal system as well. And the fact that he's basically doing a land grab. And there's even something quite calculated in about the way that he courts and finally marries Emma in the sense of, I'll agree to live under your father's roof. I'm sure her vast fortune and the house that's going to be left to her and the fact her land abuts his and would extend his property greatly has no influence at all on his decision to marry her.
Let's say it does.
So there's that. And again, there's lots and lots of other themes in there as well. But you have Frank Churchill and... Oh, I can't remember the name of the other female character. The one who would have made a better friend. She's gone ahead. But there's the whole deception thing going on there with him as well. And
is it Jane Fairfax or Harriet Smith?
Jane Fairfax.
Jane Fairfax, yeah.
Who is a basically Jane Fairfax is who Emma should try to emulate, instead of, you know, picking someone who isn't going to challenge her as a friend, which is what Harriet Smith would do.
Yeah.
So there's that entire idea of being the best you can be. And what always struck me is you've got Emma's hypochondriac father saying, oh, we mustn't stir outdoors, and him saying that he feels quite anxious when he goes outdoors. Is that possibly because he's a man in his 60s and the land has literally changed so he doesn't recognise things anymore because all these enclosures are happening?
Yeah.
So it's very, very strongly in the text, I think.
Yeah. Also the fact that, you know, Emma herself feels very enclosed. And also that there's this sense of different territories. She loses everybody one by one and they all just disappear onto different territories. And suddenly those spaces don't feel accessible anymore. They're not accessible.
Yeah.
And she feels very, very enclosed in. And she's a smart character as well. You know, she runs and she's very happy to run the household, you know, and she claims that that's all that she wants. But something else that really comes up is that we do get that theme as well of family, and the fact that there are three different families in the book where the mother dies either in childbirth or where the mother is gone and the children don't actually have a parent anymore. Now, in some cases, they get sent away. There's two cases where they get sent away. So Frank Churchill he gets sent away.
Again, part of that familial adoption process.
Exactly. Same with Jane Fairfax. She gets sent away. And Emma doesn't. Emma stays in her household. Kind of what happens, you know, the fact that he didn't have a wife anymore. He could have sent her away. He could have just sent her to go and live somewhere else and then return when she was a fully formed, you know, young woman.
Yeah.
But he doesn't. He chooses to keep her. And she grows up in this very, very enclosed life, which is also an incredibly privileged life. But it does mean that she's constantly in the power of older men. And even though she does have some good female influences because she has her sister and stuff like that, her whole kind of understanding of the female role is one of marriage, even though she herself doesn't actually want to get married, she claims.
And she doesn't really need to either. You know, she's not going to be one of those impoverished, pitiable spinsters. She's going to have wealth. She's going to have somewhere to live. She doesn't need to get married if she doesn't want to.
Yeah, but she is desperately lonely.
I think she's bored as well, and the boredom is what makes the mischief for a lot of it.
Yeah.
And also is so deliciously entertaining, because that plot line is actually very funny and quite embarrassing. It's a lot of secondhand embarrassment for a Jane Austen book.
A lot of secondhand embarrassment. And also I think I kind of feel like Jane Austen was poking fun a little bit at herself.
Yeah.
There. So she wasn't a matchmaker. Though she wasn't a matchmaker, she was writing all of these kind of romance novels with these, what was at least made to look like these perfect pairs. And she has Emma doing the same. Emma starts to see it as a kind of fiction as well. And she no longer thinks about the fact that she's actually dealing with real people and real lives that have real consequences.
Yeah,
so I quite like that.
Yeah, as you say, she's a privileged rich girl who is playing with other people like their toys. And she can be incredibly naive about things as well. She's not as grown up and switched on as she thinks she is.
No.
But that doesn't mean that Mr. Knightley gets to lecture her all the time, all the way through the book, like he does. And then the fact that she bears up under his lecturing, or, you know, is, you know, fairly robust against it, the fact he then presents that during his proposal as a reason that they ought to get married is kind of like, that's bad. That's not a good basis for a marriage. It's like, you like lecturing people and she seems to bear up with it quite well. That's not a good reason. I know there's genuine affection there, but I sometimes feel that Emma is also caving to expectation because it makes sense to her. But having said that, I think she would be more likely to keep Mr. Lightley under some sort of proportion than anybody else would. Let's go on to Persuasion, which is actually my favourite Jane Austen novel. and we'll whip through this one quite quickly.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these themes sort of carry on all the way through. Persuasion follows Anne Elliot, who's probably the oldest of Jane Austen's heroines.
Yeah.
And 7 years earlier, she was persuaded not to marry Captain Wentworth, the man she was in love with. She was 19, and her aunt thought that she was too young, that Captain Wentworth, who was not a captain at the time, he'd just joined the Navy. He would have been a sailor, but he hadn't made it to captain. He didn't have wealth. And she was persuaded to refuse his proposal, which absolutely broke his heart.
Yeah.
And Anne never fell in love with anybody else and couldn't bring herself to marry anyone else. So she kind of lived quite a sad, almost half existence with her very, very vain sister and her incredibly vain father, who have been spending money like water. And, you know, they're basically ruined. They're going to have to let their house out and then move somewhere, take lodging somewhere else.
Yeah.
In order to save money. And they move to Bath. And then there's a trip. It turns out that Captain Wentworth's come back for a bit. Anne Elliot is thrown into his company, but he wants nothing to do with her because she turned him down, even though she was in love with him. And he hasn't really ever forgiven her for it.
Yeah.
But now he's a captain. He's got good money coming in. He's looking for a wife. And his choice sort of falls on the impetuous but very spirited Louisa, who, as it turns out, isn't terribly sensible. And it goes on from there. And it's the novel that people say not very much happens. And that's not true. It's just that the character journey is so incredibly internal that I think perhaps some people can't access it. But it's a brilliant self-contained little story about looking back and making your choices slightly differently as you go forward. This is about taking a risk. The future is unknown. It's uncertain. But, you know, you want to reject the... Because Anne has the ability to marry her cousin. He's actually very interested in her. And she'd get to keep her own surname. So, yeah. And also Rick. and she'd be mistress of their house again, because that's the guy who has let the house out from them. So she'd be getting all of her old life back, but it was a constrained old life, one that prevented her marrying someone she was in love with.
Yeah.
And ultimately she chooses Captain Wentworth, or rather she presents to him the fact that, you know, the great claim of women, and it's not one that he need envy, is that they will love longest when all hope of obtaining the object of their affection is gone. And that kind of breaks down his walls. And he's been gradually softening towards her, remembering that he's been in love with her the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's really nice. It's again, it's another partnership of equals where they claim each other, but they are kind of coming from the perspective of being much older and wiser. And, you know, and deciding, okay, for 26 was starting to be a bit on the shelf for a woman in Jane Austen's time. But the fact that you have these older characters coming together with the benefit of hindsight. And Anne even says, you know, at 19, I probably didn't know what I was getting myself into, but I've had 7 years to think about it. And you know what? I still do want to marry you. There was something really nice about the sort of completion of the circle there.
Yeah. And I like the fact that it's a return of affections and that it's not some stranger comes to town. I mean, you get that a little bit with Emma as well, because obviously they have known each other since she was born.
He even says during his I'm going back to this because this is just weird. It's like, I held you in my arms when you were on the day you were born. I'm like, okay, you were 15 and you held her as a baby. You've kind of been her older brother all the way. There's something a bit bleh. But okay. Tangent, I beg your pardon.
That it was two people who were in love with each other and circumstances pulled them apart, but it's very hopeful as well.
Yes.
And from what I understand, Jane Austen, she did have some heartbreak in her life in that she did fall in love.
Oh, there's a bit of mythology there.
There's a bit of mythology. Okay, so I don't know for sure. I certainly think that she experienced love, whether it was with the people that is claimed or whether it was with someone else, I don't know. And yeah. regardless of what happened, we know that she never married, or that if it was that she didn't marry because she was in love with another woman, that they couldn't. And so there's something very hopeful about persuasion, in that regard, in that love can prevail.
Yeah, it's the absolute.
Even when bad things have happened and poor choices have been made.
Yeah, it is a perfect second chance romance on that surface yeah. as well. And it is about sort of like, you actually can't predict what life is going to do. You've just got to make the best choices you can at the time. And there is something very hopeful about that, as you said. Referring to Jane Austen and the man that she was supposedly in love with, there isn't actually a lot of evidence that she sort of preferred him, but there's no evidence she was actually in love with him. He probably liked her a lot more. He actually named one of his daughters after her, but both of them knew there was no chance they would ever be able to marry. So while I enjoy the Becoming Jane Austen film with Anne Hathaway, there's no evidence that Jane ever tried to elope with him or did anything like that, or even thought that she would at any point get to marry him. And there was no chance, and both of them knew that from the very beginning. There was one incident, I think, where his uncle said something that was embarrassing to her, but it was more a case of it was an embarrassment than anything else. In her letters, she speaks of him with a lot of levity, as in sort of like, oh yes, I'll be heartbroken because I was at least twice as in love with him as I was with the man I told you about last time, three times as much as the man before, that kind of thing. She's joking. She's joking around, and she knows that she's got no chance of marrying him.
Okay.
But it doesn't make such a good story, so people are disappointed with it. It's like, ignore the facts. Okay. Let's round off, because we've really overshot. Let's round off with Sanderton, which... there's only 12 chapters of that in existence because Jane Austen unfortunately died not long afterwards.
Yeah, she never got to finish it.
No. But this is probably what brought us to this point. Madeline and I have both been watching the ITV adaptation by Andrew Davis.
Yeah.
Whose name we're mentioning again.
Yeah.
And he's brought in a lot of the themes we've been talking about through her other books.
Definitely. And I think also because it's an even more modern audience, he can bring them very, very sharply to the forefront in some not so subtle ways.
Yeah, to the point where even a bit of the dialogue was a bit on the nose, but I thought actually that's, I can see why you would want to make it that explicit considering the time frame this is being produced in. But things that people were kind of really scandalous. I don't want to give too many spoilers for the show, but let's say there's a sexual encounter that people are sort of, about. And I'm like, have you guys never actually read her book? She may not be explicit about what physically is happening on the page, but it's not like she shies away from it. So that's really not out of left field.
Yeah.
And also, yes, Georgiana Lamb was supposed to be a black character from the very start. If you read the early chapters, Georgiana Lamb is a black character from Antigua.
Yeah.
So Jane Austen was hundreds of years ahead of her contemporaries in terms of things like, you know, representation. She was being very ambitious and once again trying to stir the political pot a lot with Sanderton, and it's a great shame that she never really got to finish it.
No, but certainly the talk of the slave trade and what was occurring because of it is very prominent in Sanderton, with, as you said, with Georgiana there, because she represents that whole aspect of it. The fact yeah. that you had these slave owners who would then have, you know, children, or would then marry some of their slaves, would then have children with them, and these children would be legitimate, you know, and back to be part of society. And then this huge comparison with the fact that at the same time, you know, there were laws being fought that, you know, dictated that first of all, that these slaves were beasts of burden, that they weren't really human, that they were subhuman, all this science that was coming out about the fact that, you know, they needed to be treated this way. It was better, you know, all of this horror that was coming through, at the same time as saying, but she is my daughter and therefore she is not any of these things.
She shall be launched into society. And it's like, they've given her, they've basically made her a billionaire in Jane Austen terms by giving her a fortune of $100,000 a year in the adaptation. And that's ridiculous wealth for the time. That's a case of, I've given her a dowry so huge that no one can object to her skin colour. And yeah. It's painful the way it's done. The fact that just that one line, that's so obviously kind of what surrounds it. And she's in that, Georgiana's in that awful position of, I'm in a society that doesn't accept me, that will never really respect me, and yet I'm a valuable commodity, and therefore I can't get rid of any of the fuckers, you know?
Yeah. And there's also the fact that, you know, they make the comment that they say, oh, it's 100,000, and it would be more if her father hadn't freed all of his slaves.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that, yeah, she has 100,000, which is built on slave labour.
Yeah.
That it comes from the horrific abuses against, you know, her mother's people, her background, and the people that she is being connected with every time she goes. So I just think that they've actually really handled that topic brilliantly, and that if Jane Austen were alive and around today and were not, you know, constrained in the same ways, she'd be like, yeah, this is exactly what I was trying to say. I genuinely believe that.
Yeah, I don't think she'd be disappointed. And obviously it's brought through a lot of the themes from the book into the series, which I won't go into too much. But the idea of exploitation, sexual exploitation within families.
Yeah.
The fact that impressionable young girls were sometimes coerced or groomed to do things that otherwise would not have occurred to them in exchange for affection that they had the right to expect. Those things are all in Jane Austen's books. It's just that when they're presented to you in an adaptation, and they're the sort of things that most people who adapt Jane Austen kind of ignore because they want to do the light romance.
Yeah.
I think it was a bit of a shock. So I've heard some very mixed things about the TV series, but personally I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so have I.
Before we just go on to our whole recommendation, going back to your initial point that people were saying that Jane Austen wasn't feminist because she only shows you things from a woman's point of view. And again, I don't think it was, and people have suggested it was because she didn't know what men got up to when women weren't around. Honestly, yeah. I don't think so. She was a brilliant observationist. I think she was writing in an era where women really were kind of stock placeholders in novels, which were mostly written by men. And
yeah.
Therefore, she wanted to write the horse's point of view and the woman's point of view.
I agree. And that's why I say that, you know, I think that's why her writing is very that's feminism right there, in that she was already doing something that was very odd of the time by saying, actually, look, I'm giving these characters who are just usually put to the side as voiceless the main voice, and the men who govern pretty much everything else don't need to say unless there is a woman present. Which I prefer in Jane Austen than that. And all of her work, it's the women and it's their point of view. And it's not that she didn't know what men were getting up to. It's that it didn't matter in her books. Just like apparently for everyone else, it didn't matter what women were getting up to unless there was a man present. So, yeah.
Right. This is going to be a long episode in case you've got this far and not worked that out.
Yeah, it is.
we're going to wrap this up now, and Dragon's recommendation.
Yeah, so our recommendation of the week, we've just been talking about it, it is Sanditon. So it's the ITV drama based on Jane Austen's unfinished novel. Certainly don't go into it if you think you're just going to be having, a lot of people sitting around drinking tea. There's a lot of that as well, but it definitely brings a lot of these topics to the front. A lot of secondhand embarrassment for the main character. Some very pretty actors. I'm just putting that out there as well.
I thought they were pretty.
I know. Very, very interesting characters, excellent pace, really worth watching. So do check it out. And on that note, we'll thank you very much for listening, guys, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.